You're listening to a special edition of Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. In the early morning hours of January 8th, 2018, as people were sleeping, mudslides in Santa Barbara County rushed into the town of Montecito. 23 people were killed. The force of boulders, coupled with rushing mud 15 feet deep, traveling at 30 miles per hour, destroyed more than 100 homes. Kim Canton and her family awoke to a downpour of rain, rushing to evacuate. But it was too late. Both she and her daughter, Lauren, were gravely injured, but were rescued from the debris more than 100 yards from where their home once stood, and they survived. However, her husband, Dave, her son, Jack, and their dog, Chester, perished. Her husband's remains were found more than a mile from their home, and it would take more than 3 years to find some of her son's remains. Kim wrote a memoir to help others find healing through tremendous grief, titled Where Yellow Flowers Bloom, A True Story of Hope Through Unimaginable Loss. Well, first, I want to start off with your husband, Dave, and your son, Jack. What would you like us to know about them and your family?
Thank you. They were some of the good guys. My husband had a kind heart. He worked from his youth all the way up, and a self-made man, and then became a scoutmaster, a Boy Scout leader in the Montecito troops, so he could spend more time with his son, and that became a very meaningful part of his life. He's very family focused, and my son, I would say, was an old soul, and he passed away at 17, but I'd say he fit in his 17 years more than some people do in their 80 years. His soul could connect to other people pretty easily. He did a lot of volunteer work, established some volunteer groups in town, and was really, loved by his friends and family.
When did you decide to write a book?
During COVID, when everything was quiet, we were all in our houses, there's not much to do. And I said, I was worried I might forget some of the details. So I said, why don't I write it down? So when I have grandkids, I have some of the facts down. And then as I started to write it, the people who were helping in the search team, some pretty stunning things occurred during that. And they said, you have to write this down. So it was kind of a combination of the COVID plus some prompting from people close to me is how that all happened.
That horrifying morning and just the aftermath of tremendous loss is very much present in your memoir. But there are also so many special and I felt these beautifully eerie moments that are also uplifting. Did you know from the beginning that was how you were going to pursue writing this book?
No, I never thought I'd ever write a book. I never thought I'd have anything to write about. It just sort of evolved, and I'd put it down for a month or two and then go back to it. And I had a few people read it and say, I want to know a little bit more about this. Like I didn't write as much about my family or Dave and Jack, kind of the personal anecdotes. And they said, we want to know who these people were. Like they, my friends knew who they were, but they said, tell a little more about that.
Prior to reading the book, it was very difficult for me to visualize what you all went through, how a mudslide could be so deadly, leaving just such little impossible room to escape. Your family had already evacuated multiple times the month prior due to the Thomas fire, and the days leading up to the mudslide, you were preparing with sandbags, you were aware that there was a risk, you and your husband were worried. But was there a way to adequately prepare for what was going to happen?
I think we did the best we could, and we had, because of the Thomas fire, they have these aware and beware notifications that are on your phone that would blast like an Amber Alert. So we had those, we had the news. So I think we relied on that information to guide our decision making. And what I would say to others is don't. If you sense any threat that's in your general area, get out, right? They miscalculated, and it was it was a perfect story. There's so much rain that came down, and then you had the mountain that didn't have foliage on it.
Yeah, and this book, I think a lot of people can resonate with the aftermath. Given that your family was awakened by this heavy downpour at 3 o'clock in the morning. I mean, so many people were sleeping.
Mm-hmm. You know, often people can use hindsight in a torturous way, like if only we had done things differently. How did you come to find peace or closure with what happened, you know, in the spirit of helping someone else who may be dwelling on how things could have been different?
That's a great question. I think it was Dave's funeral. The priest, his sermon was on don't do the woulda, coulda, shouldas. And I come with strong faith, and I know we all did the best we could in the moment with the information we had. My daughter did the best she could, you know, because she had a feeling something bad was going to happen, and she tried to tell us. And we did the best we could because we were following the news and watching our Aware and Beware, and we put the sandbags down. So I think for me is, and I've learned in grief, be gentle on yourself, right? I don't think there's many coincidences in life, and maybe it was their time. Maybe, you know, they graduated, they're in pure joy. They did what they were supposed to do on earth and evolved the way they should. And maybe they graduated, but the priest helped me with the don't do the coulda, woulda, shouldas.
Yeah. I mean, you bring up intuition, and that is such a powerful thread throughout your memoir. I mean, this overarching mm-hmm. lesson of listening to your gut or your intuition, but not only yours, mm-hmm. but listening to others as well when they share things mm-hmm. with you. What did that teach you? Because, I mean, you wrote, and I believe in part you said, like, I was listening to other people's intuition that I may have overlooked in the past.
Yeah. This really filleted me open, right? And I knew because I lost everything. You know, I didn't even have ID with me. I didn't have a passport. I didn't have a birth certificate, nothing. I had to rely on other people. And I knew because I was a high doer. I normally took care of everything. I knew in this situation, I was put in a situation I couldn't. And so I had to trust the process. I just kind of learned to trust the process. And part of it was because I was stripped so vulnerable and bare, and I couldn't put up the barriers to say, I'm going to take care of it all myself, because it wasn't possible. I was so injured. I was, had nothing. My girlfriends gave me clothes out of their closet. You know, it was, then you just kind of learn, trust the process. And the sister at the church, she kept saying, and at first it got me mad. She goes, all in God's time, and God's time's the right time. And I'm like, yeah, I don't really buy that. And then, you know, the search went on. It was 3 years, and I think she was absolutely right. So she was telling me in that message, trust the process. Just trust.
Yeah. I mean, it's incredible that you were able to find, you know, part of your son's remains Memorial Day of 2021. Mm. So that was more than mm-hmm. 3 years of just dedicated, tenacious mm-hmm. rescue efforts from you, from loved ones. But you also brought mm-hmm. in anthropologists as well. Mm-hmm. How mm-hmm. formative were those, or fundamental were those anthropologists in helping give you some closure?
They're terrific. And we tried to do everything. You know, we brought in ground penetrating radar. We had historical search dogs. We had search and rescue dogs, because they're different. We tried to do all the logical stuff, how we cleared things and observed. But then I talked to a friend of mine who is a detective, and I told him what we had done. And he says, I think you need a forensic anthropologist. And I had never heard that term before. I said, well, where do I find one of those? And he says, at a local university, they'll have one. So I wrote a university and explained who I was and say, this is what the detective said, because it had been a while now. And at first we were looking for, you know, an intact large male, and we came to realize we may not get intact. And so she responded right away, and no one thing made the difference. However, if we were going to find our needle in the haystack, we needed them. And they actually found some needle in the haystack by their meticulous techniques and their science and all that they had. But it was really, it was kind of a culmination of so many things. All the different elements helped get us toward what we ended up, you know, finding.
You had, you know, so many of these almost like full circle moments, because you had mm-hmm. reminders of your son over the years. You would find them as you were trying to search for him. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. what I think about is the significance that, and also this is going off of your intuition, you took family photos just a couple months before all of this happened, that including your family dog, Chester. How did mm-hmm. that location come into play years later after finding your son's remains?
Yeah, I tell that story and others in the book, but that was fascinating because it was just really maybe a month before the tragedy. I just had this overwhelming sense, I need to get family pictures. I just have to get them. And then I got them done and I said, and I need ones of the dog. And it was right before Christmas. I didn't want to spend the extra money, but I just had this really strong pull. And my friend took us to this area that was beautiful, this open space with coastal oaks and a beautiful creek. And it was just pretty and staged lovely boulders at the time when I thought boulders were lovely. And we sat there. And what was pretty mind-blowing is after when we were looking for Jack, I wanted to get like clues and stuff. And I asked the photographer, would you walk me where we took the pictures? And unbelievably, it's where we had been getting the clues and where we'd been searching, but it looked different now, but that's the exact same place. So it was just, you just kind of shake your head and going, what coincidence.
Yeah. Why the title, Where the Yellow Flowers Bloom?
It's a metaphor, right? And I give my daughter credit for that. The debris pile where Jack's remains were found on, the soil was like a toxic soup. It had arsenic. It had broken sewage stuff. It was just a mess. It was people's garage paints. And you would think nothing could grow there. And when we got there, it was graced with beautiful yellow flowers. So it's really a metaphor to look for the beauty when you think there might be none. Because what the student said to me, she clipped some of the flowers and she brought them to me in a vase and she said, life found a way. And I said, no, love found a way.
That is just beautiful and so powerful. You know, this book, this memoir really is very much about finding healing to give to others, to pay it forward, given the support that you received under something unimaginable and that invaluable support shown by others. But I think it's also important to understand the toll of trauma that you and your daughter, who was just 14 years old at the time, endured. I mean, you lead mm-hmm. the book with that. I mean, it's a letter of recommendation for college that was written by one of Lauren's firefighter rescuers. She was entombed, essentially, under debris. Her body was contorted for hours with little space for air. You know, how was it to read that as her mother? I know you probably had conversations about what you both went through, but to get that perspective from a rescuer to just see what she went through as a young girl.
Oh, it breaks your heart because as a parent, right, every parent wants to protect their child and you feel like you went there to protect her, to help her. She was totally alone and it breaks your heart to feel everything that she had to endure. And it was kind of awe-inspiring to get the sense of how strong she really was, her character, her resolve. She's the strongest person I know.
I think also the fact that this was a letter of recommendation for college, it kind of encapsulates that although life goes on and love finds a way, we're also shaped by our past.
Mm-hmm. Sure we are. And in the hospital, I remember when all this was going down, one of the first things I said to Lauren, I said, this will not define us. I do not want this event to define us. It will have an impact. But this is, we are other people. We are people who like to go camping. We are like to go swimming. She's going to go off and have a great career after college. She's going to get married, maybe, and have kids. This is one element, not the element in our life.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, I'm talking with Kim Canton, a survivor of the deadly Montecito mudslides in 2018, about her debut book, Where the Yellow Flowers Bloom. It's a memoir to help others find hope through unimaginable loss after losing her husband, son, and family dog to the disaster. Both she and her daughter, Lauren, survived. How is Lauren doing today?
She's doing well. She's just one amazing gal. She did ran an event relative to the book launch with some friends and the firefighters and, you know, the people who had really helped. And she surprised me singing a Joni Mitchell song, which was it just brought everyone to tears because it was so moving, you know, it was talking. What is it about the clouds? the Joni Mitchell songs about clouds. It was just wonderful. Everyone knows the song.
You mentioned songs. I mean, you have song titles for each part of the book. Were mm-hmm. those songs cathartic for you over the years, or did they come to you as you were writing?
They just came to me. I'm like, what would be a good one for this? And actually on Jack's memorial video, they put the Jack Johnson's Better Together song to it. And I said, you know what? I'm talking about what my family was like before the mudslide. So Better Together is a good title. Mm-hmm. So it just kind of, you know, came to me.
I also love that a lot of your book, there are these personal recollections. It's almost like a diary, you know, these seemingly mundane, everyday moments that we can all just very easily take for granted. But with the hindsight that you have of loss and grief, you know, I think any of us would give anything to get those moments back. Did that teach you to be more present in life today?
Absolutely. I think I am. I think that's one of the silver linings is I try just to be present in the moment. And what someone told me once, what makes people maybe unhappy is if they get attached to a specific outcome. Like, I really want that car. If I don't get that car, life's not going to be good, right? And so you get all tied up wanting this one car and that car doesn't happen or whatever it is. What I've learned is if you're just present and don't get tied to a specific outcome of I need this or I need that, kind of live a more peaceful life, I think.
Mm-hmm. You also mentioned that you're a person of faith, but you write in the mm-hmm. book that, you know, you're just very welcoming of other cultures and traditions mm-hmm. and ways of healing.
Sure.
You had a Native American ceremony for Jack. Mm-hmm. You used, I believe it would be considered a medium to help find mm-hmm. your son's remains. And one mm-hmm. of Jack's favorite quotes that he put into a time capsule at school was a Buddhist scripture. Where did all of this come from? Because it encompasses your family, not just you.
I'm just open to it all, right? I just you know, I'm Christian and, you know, our family, you know, went to church and, you know, I grew up in the Christian faith and, you know, was a Sunday school teacher, but I'm, you know, it's a big, big world and a lot of people and however they want to view a higher power or how to live life, I'm absolutely open and acknowledgement. Yeah, I think it's terrific.
In the years since, when it comes to grief, it can be shared with loved ones, but it's also very personal and individual. What advice do you mm-hmm. have for someone who perhaps is a caregiver or a parent, a guardian, helping, you know, themselves let grief move through them, but also someone who's younger, like your daughter, Lauren? How did you guys experience grief together, but also separately?
That's a great question. What you have to realize is everyone's grief journey is different, right? My daughter was 14. I was in my early 50s. Her 14-year-old brain could only handle what a 14-year-old brain could want to process, and her unique trauma was different from mine. So that impacted it. So everyone's grief journey is individual and acknowledging that. And I think of grief as a big bowl of messy spaghetti. It's messy and you don't know what you're going to get and it hits you sometimes as a wave. And I would just say, hold on. I have a dear friend of mine who lost his wife in fall. And I remember saying to him, you know, when I saw him one day, he looked kind of sad. And I just said, it's going to get better. Right? I was a few years out from him in my grief journey. But hold on. There's a song by Wilson Phillips, China Phillips. And it's hold on for one more day. Just hold on. It's going to get lighter.
Given that this winter season, I mean, atmospheric rivers once again prompted evacuations in the area. I was reading an LA Times article and the headline was, you know, 5 years to the day after deadly mudslides, rains again force families from their Montecito homes. How do you navigate that, you know, every year, you know, potentially having just the memory at least of what happened?
Well, I have trauma related to that. I can tell, like, when I'm in town and when that happened, the wear and beware blasts were going off. They were doing evacuations. And I was more hypervigilant. You know, I didn't want to, if it was raining, I told my daughter and I, we are not driving on the streets. Whereas normally people might drive on the street to go to the grocery store. And I was just, no, we're not going on the street. This is, and then I was really vigilant. So I'm working with my EMDR trauma therapist to see if they can help lessen that. I know I was in two different areas when there was heavy rain this past 3 months, and one was a place that I grew up, and it was raining there, and it didn't bother me at all because that place never let me down before, right? this place has let me down. Then I was on the Northeast doing a visiting someone and it rained in, didn't bother me there. So what I'm learning in my trauma is that it is specific to this area because the mountain did come down and it's a risk here. And, so I'll have to navigate that and see what that, you know, what the implications are for me with that.
Finally, Kim, what do you hope readers take away from your book?
Yeah, you know, I really hope my biggest goal is this book lands in the hands of someone who can find some hope in it, right? Like, I'm the poster child of bad things that happen. You know, house washes away, husband dies, 17-year-old son dies, dog dies, like, daughter's buried alive. It's all check the box of bad, bad, and bad. I hope they can see through my journey of the desperate grief to more peaceful adaptation, that they too can get through it. And maybe some of the things I learned might help them. That's all. That's the whole purpose of the book.
Kim, thank you so much for making the time.
Thank you. Take care now.
Kim Canton is a survivor of the deadly Montecito mudslides in 2018, sharing her debut book, Where Yellow Flowers Bloom, a memoir to help others find hope through tremendous loss after losing her husband, son, and family dog to the disaster. Both Kim and her daughter Lauren survived. You're listening to a special best of edition of Insight here on Cap Radio. We're celebrating the halfway mark of 2023, spending the hour listening back to some of the best conversations we've had so far this year. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.